Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Vishala Sripathma. On today's programme, a bump in the road, or are the wheels falling off? Tesla cuts jobs and drops the price of its cars. We find out whether Elon Musk can turn it around. Also, we hear from Ecuador, where people have voted yes to the army patrolling the streets, where gang violence has stopped people from going to work.
Farmers are facing also that situation of robbery. So they're stealing cacao at night, mainly, because now cacao has become the most precious commodity we have in Ecuador.
And the weather might not be as warm, but we hear about how film producers are swapping Hollywood for the Emerald Isle. Our reporter is in Belfast for the show today. And remember, you can email us at any time on world.business@bbc.co.uk. Well, let's begin in Silicon Valley. Tesla's having a bit of a bumpy ride at the moment. Last week, it announced it was cutting its staff by 10%. And earlier on Monday, the company said it was slashing prices of its most prized electric vehicles in some key markets like the US, China and Germany. Now, you don't have to dig too deep to find out the reasons behind these decisions. Sales are sluggish and its self-driving technology hasn't quite hit the milestones required for rollout. So where does this leave the self-styled company of the future, the car company of the future at least, and its much coveted owner, Elon Musk? Well, joining me now is Michael Furtick, a tech entrepreneur and investor, and also our markets guest today, Rachel Winter from Killick & Co. Welcome to you both. Michael, we're going to start with you. Michael, what's going wrong at the moment for Tesla, do you think?
Thanks, Vishala. Nice to be with you. First thing I'll say is I'm not a stock commentator. I'm sure your other guests will do a good job of that. I'll just comment on the company and the landscape. I actually don't think things are going wrong at Tesla. Tesla's doing fine. I'd be leery of betting against Tesla, sort of broadly speaking. I'm not talking about the stock price, just about their future. They've built a huge defensive moat we can talk about technically, from their battery to their over-the-airways upgrades of their software subscriptions, which will probably be, you know, $20 billion plus per year in a few years. The change that's good, that's afoot is that Chinese companies have been making EVs, electric vehicles, now recently, and have been making them at a great pace. And the government there in China has been subsidizing the production and the purchase. And then recently, just a few months ago, China stopped subsidizing the purchase of these EVs. So the Chinese companies are stuck with all this excess inventory, and they're dumping the products in Europe, especially. So the sales have been... the prices have been undercut because the Chinese companies have to make up for all this sort of over surge of inventory. So I think it's probably reasonably temporary, and I think Tesla will be, you know, right back on top pretty soon.
Okay, Michael. Rachel, I want to bring you in now. The share price of Tesla is down 40% year to date. Investors possibly need some reassurance then.
Yeah, it really has been quite a roller coaster. So if we go back a bit further, the shares multiplied by 20 between 2019 and 2021, and then they are down about 65% from their peak in 2021. So anyone who's been in them for a few years will still be sitting on a very big profit, but they have been very up and down more recently, and I think that will have scared quite a few people.
Michael, you mentioned there about electric vehicles, the market, about the Chinese influence over the market, about lots of cars flooding in from China. Do you think this is then therefore a reflection of the wider industry?
Yeah, I do think, look, I think Elon Musk taught the world that electric vehicles are both possible and exciting, right? The first Tesla was effectively a sports car, and it was exciting to look at. And the following cars have been exciting to look at, exciting to drive, exciting to be in. They're like spaceships on wheels, right? So that's what makes them so beloved. And then they work very well, and they got great reliability and all these things, and they save you money and so forth. So people got excited about EVs. And then when anyone gets that excited about something, the competition will emerge, and that's healthy. That's normal, both in America and overseas in China. The market for electric vehicles is not immediately today as large as people thought it was going to be immediately today or by now, because, well, the electric vehicles are more expensive than gas vehicles in many cases. They're more expensive than hybrid vehicles in many cases. And also people are still afraid of the range anxiety, like how far can I actually drive, which in the UK may not sound like a big deal on one charge, but in America, which is a giant country, it's crazy anxiety, whether it's justified or not. So, you know, soon enough, the availability of electrical power and refueling will be more pervasive, and this anxiety will come down. Batteries will get better, right? The batteries of today cost $10,000 or so, and a few years ago, they would have cost $1 million. I mean, these technologies are really getting better very fast, and Tesla's been leading the way. But right now, there's a bit of a glut in the market, and China, which generally makes, you know, lower quality products at lower prices, and then dumps them the way that the Japanese were dumping minivans in the United States in the early 90s, which led to a major trade war that not only lasted a while, but broke Japan, fundamentally broke their economy. You're seeing that now with Chinese EVs. So I think that the technical moat that Tesla has built up around batteries, around the Powerwall, the over-the-air upgrades, the subscription business, I think these are things that are going to be hard to defeat long-term. But right now, the price cut war is on, and it could be painful for everyone, including Tesla.
And it's interesting, Michael, because, you know, they've got this sort of celebrity owner, Elon Musk, that lots of people are interested in. And also he's cleverly marketed Tesla as a technology company when they're selling cars.
It's true. You know, there are a lot of people who go on TV. I'm often on TV with them. Who say that Tesla is like a software company on wheels. I don't know why that's true. It would be awesome if it were true. It is definitely running a lot of advanced software and edge computing and all these other things that they do extraordinarily well, best in class. Also, by the way, their factories are heavily roboticized, right? So they can make these cars in this automatic way, nearly fully automated in many parts of the production. Incredible. I don't know why that makes Tesla a software company on wheels. It's still an incredible car company. I don't know why it makes it a battery company. Some people say the Powerwall will be the battery of the future. But I do think there is one thing that can be said, which is that there will come a time, which is not too far from now, I believe. I don't know when. No one knows when all of a sudden, all around the world, they'll flip a switch and all these Teslas will be driving autonomously and people's lives will be saved. There'll be fewer crashes. There'll be great self-driving cars like automatically and automagically. That's cool. But I don't think you need to believe it's a software company to believe it's incredible and it's strong in the future. Again, they may influence the stock price, but that's not me.
Okay, Michael, we'll have to leave it there. Whereabouts in the world are you today? Because you travel a lot. I wasn't sure where your location is.
I'm in Paris, France. They're going to have the Olympics here. You might have heard of it. Very nice. Paris in the spring. Nice place. Good wine, cheese. They have all that stuff.
Well, sounds great.
Wine and happy Passover to everyone listening. Chag Sameach. Happy Passover.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for joining us. That's tech entrepreneur and investor Michael Furtick, and Rachel will be with us throughout the programme. Well, let's turn our attention now to Central America, because Ecuador has just held a referendum on bolstering security in the country. The poll was called after the nation went from being relatively peaceful to having the highest recorded murder rate in Latin America. This man, a cocaine dealer called El Gato, or the Cat, told the BBC that Ecuador's economic problems are behind the violence.
I started selling and smoking when I was 14 years old. We went through financial problems. My mother was always working and never there for me. I was alone in the house crying and screaming for my mom. Then I met my friends, bad friends, who introduced me to drugs. I believe that the country's economic crisis is what led to so much crime.
Well, Ecuadorians have voted in favour of allowing the military to patrol their streets. They also backed longer prison terms and extraditing violent criminals. But crucially, people voted no to some of the economic questions in the referendum, a clause which would allow workers to be contracted by the hour, and another on international corporations. Well, to explain why these particular points did not pass, I spoke to the BBC's Matias Ibas Garcia, who covers the region.
Ecuador is one of the countries in South America with the biggest informal job employment. It's like 54-55% of the people who has a job in Ecuador is an informal job. They don't pay taxes, they don't have a social security. So what is the idea of the government? If we flexibilize, if we make easier the rules to contract people, we will incorporate more people to the formal market. But that is the government argumentation. The opposition says no, it's going to be completely the opposite. What do you want as a president is to help your businessman friends to hire, but to fire as well easily all the employees, all the job seekers. So it's controversial because that idea is going to help people to get a formal job, or it's going to help companies, industries, exportations, trade to fire people easily, or to pay less money, or to hire people just for partial employment and not for a permanent employment. Ecuador has a long story of international companies exploiting natural resources. It has oil, it has gold. People were afraid that they would be more vulnerable to this kind of exploitation if the international arbitration will decide if a company or the Ecuadorian state is right or wrong.
Now, there are other economic issues at play here. So, for example, energy security is a challenge. There was a blackout on Friday, and there were several blackouts over the last few months, and a state of emergency was declared. Tell us a little about that.
Okay, first of all, you have a climate reason that, you know, Colombia, Ecuador at the moment are suffering from a drought, a really low level of rain because the El Nino phenomenon. So you have a climate reason. But in the second, another reason is like lack of investment. The energetic sector has been suffering from a lot of lack of investment because the economic situation is critical, not in the last year or the last 2 years. It's been for 5, 6, 7 years. So if you don't have investment in the hydroelectric sector, if you don't have investment in the electrical sector, you will suffer when you have less rain. So yes, it's a crisis, and it's really tough because the president has to declare Thursday and Friday a completely blackout. People didn't go to work and didn't go to study, didn't go to schools because they needed all the energy possible for Sunday for the referendum.
And that really does, like you say there, I mean, these situations really impact people's ability to work.
Absolutely.
And I presume the energy situation, but also the security situation, does impact someone's choice to leave their house and go to work.
Yes. Ecuador has always been a country that exports a lot of people. A lot of people goes away from Ecuador for the last 20 years. And mostly the people left Ecuador for the economic situation. They go to United States for a better job. They go to Spain or Italy. But now when people are starting to ask Ecuadorian why they are leaving the country, you have slowly but gradually another reason. For example, people who has to pay to a criminal group to have the business open. These informal taxes, or people who says the state is not present in my neighborhood, in my province, and I have to deal with criminals and I cannot work, I cannot have a company, So gradually, slowly but gradually, you have more insecurity reasons behind the emigration of Ecuadorians.
The BBC's Matthias Zibas Garcia there. So what's it like on the ground in Ecuador? Well, Susana Cardenas is a cocoa producer on the Ecuadorian coast. I asked her which way she voted.
I vote for a change because it has been really rocketing times for Ecuador lately, and we really needed to have a change. It's the beginning of a change.
And you have your own business. You grow cocoa and you produce chocolate, and you have your own business in your own name. Do you find it hard to operate your business in these circumstances, in these surroundings and the environment at the moment that Ecuador finds itself in?
Well, that's a great question, Michala. I think it's beyond that. When you love what you do and you have the passion and determination and purpose of what you're doing is the right thing, you overcome any situation. Has it been easy? No. Has it been challenging? Yes. Not only because of the security on the streets, of being not being able to feel safe while going to the countryside to see the harvest. I'm a woman leading this venture. So for me, it has feel it's like feeling like we have to go through a roller coaster, because it's still a very macho environment. So you have to be much more cautious. But I have a great team here in place that I've been working for a few years. You know, I have the right people that I go with, the driver, the leading member of our team in the countryside is a person I trust, I know. So we have a very committed team supporting us. So that's a wonderful help.
What sort of precautions do you have to take? Because presumably theft is a problem, and also the threat of violence. What do you have to do to protect yourself?
You know what? We keep very low key. When I say low key, it's like we're not showing what we have. We are doing the things in a very quiet way still. But yes, we have to be careful, not driving long hours very late at night. There are areas that we can't go at night. Manta is my hometown, which is a port. So I would say it's the number fourth city in Ecuador. There are areas that we can't go. You hear so much violence and deaths in that area that you don't go. But the area where we work and where I live is relatively quiet. But still, you have to be careful. You can't be walking on the streets with your telephone, just speaking like, you know, like nothing is happening. No, you have to be very cautious in that sense.
And we hear about a lot of theft of cocoa as well, because the prices of cocoa at the moment are quite high.
Yeah, that's happening quite often. Farmers are facing also that situation of robbery. So they're stealing cacao at night, mainly, because now cacao has become the most precious commodity we have in Ecuador. And the fact that there is a lack of cacao in the fields, it makes it more precious.
That was Susana Cardenas, a cocoa farmer in Ecuador. And you can read more about the situation in Ecuador on the BBC website. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World.
I knew right at that moment that my whole life was gone. I'm going to jail for a very, very long time. There was no doubt about it.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast with astonishing personal stories from across the globe.
And honestly, even at that point of reporting to a journalist, I don't think I really knew that that was in itself an act of whistleblowing.
Expect the unexpected.
The only future is death here. So if we live, we might have a chance. We will die anyway, but we will die trying.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Service. Well, it might not come as a surprise that military spending has increased in the last year, with wars in Europe, the Middle East and Africa. But for the first time, there's been an increase in defence spending in all five geographical regions, including in countries like India and Japan. Well, earlier I spoke to Lorenzo Scarzato from the CIPRI Military Expenditure and Arms Production Programme in Stockholm, who explained why.
I would say that in general, the whole world has been increasing, as you said. All the regions have been increasing. When it comes to specific countries, perhaps the most surprising ones are not the big ones, as in the US is still the big dog here. US and China still account for 50% of the world military expenditure. I would say perhaps some countries like Algeria, which has been benefiting from Europe trying to diversify his gas revenue. Algeria was able to spend more because of increased revenue because they sold gas to Europe. Algeria is the biggest spender in North Africa. And since they were able to sell more gas, they were able also to increase their military expenditure. When we move to Europe, perhaps we can see how Poland, was the highest increase year on year in the whole of Europe. And perhaps the last one, I would say Japan. Japan is quite the case. It's in Asia, has been trying to maintain a policy of 1% of GDP dedicated to military expenditure, and yet in 2023 increased by 11% year on year, moving past the 1% target that has been respecting for decades. And now we see how Japan is trying to move to 2% of GDP dedicated to military expenditure, and they're planning on doing that to 2027.
What we've seen in these statistics is that some countries that you expect that have been spending money on their defences, and as you mentioned, sort of countries like Japan that perhaps were a bit of a surprise, but also in terms of the different purposes that countries spend on their defence. So, for example, in Central America, in Mexico, increased spending there to try and tackle gang violence, for example.
Yes, in Central America, you're right. We've seen how the army has been used to tackle gang crimes. That's the case also in El Salvador. And we see how, yes, countries are resorting to hard security to tackle problems that otherwise could or would require perhaps a different approaches. And that's definitely the reflection of a world that is somewhat losing hope into diplomatic solutions, or at least soft power.
And also India, for example, increasing its spending, so it becomes more self-reliant on arms as well.
Yes, we know how India has some border skirmishes with China, but also they are trying to definitely bolster their self-reliance to avoid the dependency that we've seen. For example, in the past years, we see how the defense industry, the arms industry, is trying to ramp up, but we've seen how there are supply chain bottlenecks, and some countries are not able to actually get what they want because their industry is not able to deliver because they are being hindered by huge backlogs, but also supply chain issues.
Are you seeing military spending then a priority for governments around the world, despite there being a backdrop, higher prices because of inflation?
I would say yes. I see how some countries are gearing up towards that. It's not immediate, but we've seen how countries are creating plans on the longer term. For example, 2023 was the year when we registered the highest per capita military expenditure.
And do you think that this trend is going to change at all? For example, Greece, Italy and Romania didn't increase their military spending in 2023. Are you expecting any changes?
I hope the trend is going to change. But the fact that three countries did not increase one year does not mean they're not increasing. If you look back at the decade, all the three countries since 2014 have been increasing their military expenditure. I would say in this respect, it's quite volatile because one year can be either a program get pushed or the money is allocated for the year after. 2023 for those three countries is not an indicator. On the longer term, we've seen how they've been increasing.
That was Lorenzo Scarzato there. Rachel Winter is still with us, our markets guest today. Rachel, I was scratching my head earlier trying to figure out who the big military hardware companies there are. And of course, there's Lockheed Martin and Raytheon. Do you think we can see more businesses and companies investing in defence?
Yeah, I mean, another example is BAE Systems, which has been very out of favour over the last decade. But the second that Russia invaded Ukraine, we saw a huge amount of investor interest in these types of companies. So BAE, for example, the shares have more than doubled since that invasion of Ukraine.
Also, we touched on Tesla at the top of the programme. They've got their figures out tomorrow, but it's a big earnings week for the tech sector, isn't it?
It is. We've got all the big tech companies scheduled to report. And I think there is a little bit of apprehension about these results because shares in big tech have had such a strong quarter. People have been quite excited about artificial intelligence, and that has led people to invest more in these companies. And as a result, the shares have come up a lot. So I think there's already quite a lot of good news priced in. So we will need some good results coming out this week to support the current share prices.
Okay, Rachel, thank you very much for joining us today. Rachel Winter there from Killick and Co, our markets guest for the programme. Well, we're going to turn our attention now to the film industry because Northern Ireland and its economy are betting big on film, TV and even gaming. Now, they're building on the success of filming the hit TV series Game of Thrones there. And it's investing millions in high technology production. And they've even managed to lure Hollywood's biggest stars from the beaches of Malibu to the Antrim coast, which is absolutely beautiful. Hannah McCarthy has been for a visit.
Game of Thrones injected tens of millions of dollars into the region's economy, which has struggled to provide high-skilled job opportunities for young people after decades of political conflict. Film director turned technology entrepreneur Hugh McGorry used to teach film at Queen's University in Belfast.
A lot of the students that I was working with ended up getting world-class experience by working at high levels on Game of Thrones.
Much of the HBO series was shot at a studio in the Docklands of Belfast, where the towering yellow cranes of the old shipbuilders Harland and Wolff still pierce the skyline. McGrory says Game of Thrones has had a hugely positive impact on the region.
On its community, but also the impact on tourism and general self-esteem. You have to remember that we're coming out of a long period of conflict.
McGrory says the world of TV and film production is innovating and moving away from traditional film sets and on-site locations.
What's coming is artificial intelligence. This isn't an incremental shift. This is a totally radical shift.
Northern Ireland is eager to be at the forefront of this AI revolution and is developing a studio equipped for world-class TV, film and gaming production. At a cost of nearly $100 million, Studio Ulster will open later this year in the Belfast docks. CEO Declan Keeney says it will have pioneering stages encased in walls of high-definition screens.
We can create real light from these walls and we can film what we call in-camera visual effects. So, for example, in Belfast, we could create Morocco by bringing in sand and creating, you know, in the round, projecting the horizon in Morocco. And so, you know, it transforms what's possible.
Keeney believes that the economic power of film, TV and gaming is not fully recognised, even though government figures show that the creative industries are worth around $135 billion to the UK.
Creative industries contribute more per year to the economy than if you combined aerospace and life sciences and the automotive sectors.
Northern Ireland is hoping that the high-tech investment will put it at the cutting edge of virtual and digital screen production in the future.
That was Hannah McCarthy reporting there. Rachel is still with us. Rachel, Netflix results were out last week. They were interesting, weren't they?
They were. I actually thought they were better than expected. So Netflix has been trying really hard to crack down on people sharing their passwords with each other. That strategy has gone very well. So they added 9.3 million new subscribers in one quarter. So that was great. But what they did say is they're going to stop reporting to the market how many new subscribers they get per quarter in future. And I think that was quite disappointing to some investors. And therefore, we did see a bit of a drop in the share price.
And it's interesting how other companies have tried to mimic that model in Hollywood and therefore have reflect that on the markets as well.
Indeed. So people really are streaming movies rather than buying them now. So most other streaming companies are really trying to crack down on people sharing passwords and trying to get as many of their own subscribers as possible. Disney Plus is another example, but I think Netflix really has led the way here.
And just a quick word on the dollar before we go, Rachel.
Yes, we have seen the dollar weakening over the last few weeks. And this is because inflation in the US has been quite sticky. And that means that interest rates in the US probably will have to remain higher for longer. That means less money will be traveling into the US. And therefore, we have seen less demand for dollars, making the dollar a bit weaker.
OK, Rachel, thanks very much for joining us throughout the programme. Rachel Winter there from Killick & Co. Don't forget, you can contact me on social media. I'm on all my socials at BBC Vishala SB, or you can email the programme. We're at world.business@bbc.co.uk. Raoul Tandon will be with you a bit later on with Business Matters. Thanks for listening.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed, but whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in these environments.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.